This hour's top stories. Iran says the lifting of U.S. sanctions is the first step to revive the 2015 nuclear deal as Tehran and the remaining signatories to the accord hold a virtual meeting. Russia says its ties with the U.S. and Europe have hit the bottom and the U.S.-led pressure on Moscow has absolutely no chance for success. Also this hour, Germany registers nearly 22,000 new confirmed coronavirus cases and a further 232 deaths. Welcome to the World News. Iran says the lifting of U.S. sanctions is the first step to revive the 2015 nuclear deal as Tehran and the remaining signatories to the accord hold a virtual meeting. Iran's deputy foreign minister said Tehran will reverse its commitment cuts under the deal as soon as it verifies the removal of sanctions. Sayed Abbas Araghchi added no negotiations are needed for Washington's return to the agreement known as the JCPOA. An informed source said that the lifting of all U.S. restrictions is the only possible way for Iran to comply with its obligations under the pact. Representatives from Iran, China, Russia, France, Britain, and Germany participating in the virtual meeting emphasized the importance of losing no time for reviving the JCPOA. The talks are due to resume next week in Vienna with ways for alleviating anti-Iran sanctions on the agenda. Political commentator Paolo Rapone says a virtual meeting between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal indicates that the U.S. is somehow ready to compromise on the JCPOA and find common ground with Iran.
Certainly it is a significant step forward, the fact that the meeting has been convened, chaired by the EU, and there is a sort of a blessing from the United States. This has to be inserted into the dialogue, which is quite complicated and at terms even tense, between the European states and the European Union with the United States following the Blinken visit to the continent. So it is clear that Europeans have at stake a great interest that this agreement with Iran resumes fully, and the United States have somehow compromised and accepted that the EU will try to break through to find a common ground between Iran and U.S. positions that, as we know, are still stuck around the lifting of sanctions from the U.S. side. So we will see if this brings some results already today, but certainly is an indication that some kind of availability from the United States to find ground for compromise is there.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country's ties with the U.S. and Europe have hit the bottom. Lavrov criticized U.S. President Joe Biden for calling his Russian counterpart a killer. Lavrov said the remarks were appalling and forced Moscow to rethink its ties with Washington. The top Russian diplomat also said the U.S.-led pressure on Russia has absolutely no chance for success. Lavrov made the comments in a televised speech. He also blamed the European Union for the collapse of ties with Russia. He said the bloc is eager to toe the policy of the U.S. on Moscow. Russia's relations with the West have soured in the past several years over a range of issues, including election meddling and human rights. Ukraine has reported record daily highs of new coronavirus cases and deaths over the past 24 hours. The health ministry registered nearly 20,000 new infections and more than 430 new deaths. Friday marks the third day in a row that daily COVID deaths hit a record in Ukraine. The government has already imposed lockdowns in several big cities, including the capital, Kyiv. Elsewhere in Europe, daily new cases were almost 22,000 in Germany on Friday. That's the second straight day new infections were above 20,000 there. Germany's Intensive Care Association has called for a national lockdown to curb the new wave of COVID. Well, coronavirus infections continue to rise in the Gaza Strip despite preventive measures by local authorities to contain the deadly pandemic. A rapid increase in COVID-19 infections is placing great pressure on Gaza's health system. Tashraf Shannon has more.
The Gaza Strip has witnessed a surge in coronavirus infections, while the number of active cases has tripled since early March. Since the beginning of the pandemic, over 66,000 Gazans have been infected with COVID-19. Daily hospitalizations due to coronavirus continue to rise, and health facilities struggle to maintain adequate surplus of fully equipped ICU units. The Israeli blockade has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and detect the spread of the coronavirus.
1,800 new coronavirus infections were detected during the past 24 hours, and that is about 29% of the total of those who were tested. 618 patients have died since March 2020. The epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is dangerous.
Rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of coronavirus spread in the Gaza Strip. Some 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are at an increasing risk of contracting the virus.
This dangerous pandemic is endangering our lives in this tiny enclave. Things were already bad before the coronavirus pandemic, mainly because of the blockade, including high poverty and unemployment rates.
We are afraid because the situation is very dangerous, and we fear that more restrictions will be imposed. The coronavirus is not a joke, and people must take precautionary measures more seriously.
The Israeli regime's illegal practices and punitive measures continue to disrupt the development of Gaza's health sector. Gaza's health system has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007.
Israel bears full responsibility for the deterioration of the health situation in the Gaza Strip and the entire health sector in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade has undermined local efforts to combat the pandemic. Gaza's health sector is in a very bad shape, and it needs all the support that it can get to fight this pandemic.
Health officials have raised the alarm over the rising figures of infections in the densely populated territory.
The coronavirus pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system. Experts say the Israeli blockade must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran has registered nearly 12,000 new coronavirus cases, the highest daily figure in around 4 months, unfortunately. The country also reported 117 more deaths from the virus, which is also a three-month high. The health ministry spokeswoman said the number of infections is increasing alarmingly and anticipated a rise in daily death figure in the coming days. Sima Sadat Lari blamed the surge in intercity travels, that is, during the New Year holidays, as well as a significant decline in the observation of health protocols. The new daily figures are still considerably less than those registered back in November when the country imposed tough restrictions to curb the pandemic. Iran has so far registered over 1.9 million infections and more than 62,000 deaths. A UK charity says the government's recent race report has ignored what it called the brutal evidence of economic inequality. The government report said institutional racism does not occur in the US. It said the country should be regarded as a model for other white majority nations. Now, Turn to Us charity says the data it has compiled show deep-rooted inequalities in UK society. It says ethnic minorities have suffered significantly greater economic hardship during the pandemic. The charity has provided statistics showing economic disparities between the minorities and the white British people. The group has urged the British government to not dismiss the reality of institutional racism and make meaningful change.
The Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities says the UK system is not rigged against people from ethnic minorities and there is no proof of institutional racism. In a report released Wednesday, it did admit that minorities still face overt racism, but insisted Britain should be regarded as a, quote, model for other white majority countries.
The report definitely touched a nerve, suggesting that disparities based on race in the economy and education are negligible. But people here in Brixton definitely disagree.
They live in their little tower and they've grown up in a certain way, but they don't see the reality of what black people are actually going through. So no, there is racism and we are not hung up. We need to just be heard that something is wrong with our bringing up our lives and how we are actually treated. Because in reality, we are seen as a different colour.
Institutional racism does exist. It exists in the education system everywhere. You can see it in a classroom. A teacher would discriminate against a black student over a white student just because he's black.
The report has been slammed as nonsense that flies in the face of all existing evidence. Flagged up are many issues that black and minority ethnics grapple on a daily basis. For example, the fact that black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched by police than white people, and black mothers are 4 times likely to die in childbirth. So is this a genuine effort to understand racism in Britain or a PR stunt? Many black artists share the view that racism today is alive and well. Junior from the British Collective says his life and career were deeply impacted by racism.
When I was a kid and I was growing up, if I played football and a white guy kicked me, I would have turned around and I might have effed him blind, but it wouldn't have crossed my mind to call him white. Vice versa, the first thing that he would do is turn around and say, you black, so and so. Not understanding for himself that he's being racist, he just took it as the norm. It hasn't changed since then. It hasn't changed in any shape, form or fashion. I hear some politicians trying to turn it into, black politicians trying to turn it into a, oh well, we've come a long way. We haven't.
The COVID-19 pandemic and the disproportionate number of deaths among black, Asian and minority ethnic people clearly illustrate that something is seriously wrong. Being much more likely to have to live in a block of flats and do a job involving a high level of exposure to the public are the sort of factors that critics say prove systemic or structural racism is real. Bianca Rahimi, London.
High-profile cases of black Americans dying at the hands of police officers have led to a racial reckoning in the United States. A Minneapolis court is now trying a former officer who is accused of murdering an unarmed African-American man by kneeling on his neck. Will justice be served in this case?
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life. The high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody.
The high-profile trial in the United States has once again brought the killing of George Floyd and the question of racial discrimination and police brutality in America back into the spotlight. Although Floyd's death triggered mass protests, racial profiling, injustice, and discrimination remain serious problems in America.
The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and five times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
To some unfortunate accident in the East Asia region, a packed train has derailed inside a tunnel in eastern Taiwan, leaving at least 48 people dead. Authorities say dozens more have been injured. The government has ordered hospitals to prepare for a mass casualty event. Officials say a truck that was not parked properly was suspected of sliding into the path of the train. It was traveling from Taipei to Taitung, carrying more than 300 people. Nearly a third of them have already been evacuated. Rescue efforts are ongoing to get access to the carriages inside the tunnel. Officials say they have deformed and they are hard to gain access to. Elsewhere, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has narrowly won a no-confidence vote in Parliament over claims he lied about coalition talks. Following the vote, Rutte promised to work terribly hard to regain trust. He was accused of covering up efforts to rein in an outspoken lawmaker during coalition negotiations. It all began last week when the talks halted after one negotiator unwittingly revealed the documents to a news photographer. That happened as the negotiator rushed out of Parliament. The document is said to show that Premier Rutte discussed making the MP a minister. At the time, Rutte said that he had not discussed that, but he later said that he remembered that wrong. Rutte's party won the most seats in last month's elections in the Netherlands.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. Support for production.
Another issue is about support for production, such as providing legal incentives and importing the materials on which the production is dependent. For example, some of our products need raw materials, which should be imported from abroad, and we also need some machinery whose importation should be facilitated. A major way to help production is to do something to increase the people's purchasing power, because without demand, a boost in production will fail to achieve its purpose. The people's purchasing power is the same as the value of national currency. This is a very important point that should be discussed by experts in due circumstances. Another way to help production is to do something to eliminate dealers and third parties, because they increase prices and producers and consumers will be hurt. Both will be hurt. If dealers and third parties, those whose existence is unnecessary, are eliminated, this will help production a great deal. There are other such measures as well. If these things are pursued seriously in the year 1400 according to the solar calendar, it will surely bring about a transformation in the area of the economy.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to be. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Fighting against corruption.
There are other conditions as well which should be observed. One of these conditions is combating corruption. Combating corruption is a very important issue. Corruption channels and outlets should be blocked. This means reforming the banking system and the customs system. The path of the corruption should be completely blocked.
Having competent managers and benefiting from capacities are necessary conditions for economic blossoming.
I want to say to the Iranian nation that because of some problems in the economic situation and in the people's livelihood conditions, some individuals have used the opportunity to fabricate negative stories, saying things such as nothing can be done in any way. Some people are like this. some individuals in cyberspace, in our press, and primarily, and unfortunately in foreign propaganda networks, use the problems that the people face as a means to portray a completely dark picture of the things, conveying the feeling that nothing can be done. However, I will tell you that this is not all the case.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Ministry.
Sana'a inaugurated the seventh year of resisting the Saudi war with a large air operation targeting several Aramco oil facilities simultaneously. A development that predicts that the precious Saudi black gold will be at the top of the list of targets of the Yemeni armed forces this year until the siege on Yemen is broken and the war comes to an end. The anniversary of the Saudi-Emirati aggression against Yemen has turned into a national day celebrated by the Yemeni people, not to commemorate the war that worsened the humanitarian situation for the majority of the people of this country, but to honor the sacrifices made by these people on various fronts. Sana'a, which was the first stop for the Saudi warplanes bombing on the morning of March 26, 2015, is today in a highly advanced military, political, security, and economic position, and has become, in the eyes of the Yemenis and whoever supports them, a symbol of resistance and steadfastness. Despite its exposure to tens of thousands of airstrikes during the past years and the decision by the government of Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi to transfer the capital to the city of Aden in the middle of the first year of the war, Sana'a remains the center of political, military, and economic decision-making by resisting aggression and facing the siege. It has achieved over the past 6 years successes on various fronts of confrontation to become a very strong counterpart for Riyadh. Last Friday, on the very early hours of the sixth anniversary of the Saudi war, the Yemeni missile force and the bomber drones unit carried out a large offensive operation against military and economic targets in the depths of Saudi Arabia. The retaliatory attack, dubbed Operation National Day of Resilience, was carried out by 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles. It targeted the headquarters of the Aramco oil facility in Yanbu'a, Yizan, and Ras Tanura, as well as the King Abdulaziz base in Dammam. Other targets were the military sites in the Najran and Dasir areas, which were hit with 6 Qasif 2K drones. These messages were accompanied by great popular support expressed in the major marches that took place during the same day in Sana'a and other governorates under control of the Salvation Government. Tens of thousands of Yemenis from the square of Sana'a Airport, which has been closed for more than 5 years by the Saudi Emirati coalition, announced their support for proceeding in the defensive battle until the foreign occupation was removed and its militias were defeated. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Welcome to Middle East Stream. 12 domestically manufactured Samad 3 combat drones, in addition to 8 ballistic missiles of Zulfiqar, Badr, and Sa'ar types, struck targets in the Saudi cities of Ras Al-Nura, Rabigh, Yanbu'a, as well as Jizan, home to key Saudi Aramco oil installations, as part of a large-scale operation, National Day of Resistance. The Yemeni armed forces also launched 6 Qasif 2K bomber drones against military sites in historic Yemeni, Najran, and Asir regions. Such a busy weekend for Mohammed bin Salman indeed. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Belgrade is Joaquin Flores, editor at Fort Hurst News website. Thank you for being with us, Joaquin. Now, we have been revisited by the Yemeni Armed Forces spokesperson, General Yahya Sariya, several times for the past couple of weeks with news of targeting Saudi Arabia's Achilles heel in Ras Tanura port, which exports about more than 80% of all Saudi oil to foreign countries by targeting Aramco oil facilities also inside the capital, Riyadh, to other military sites in Dammam and Khamis al-Mushayt, added to that Jizan and Najran. Will it take longer than that till this actually brings Saudi Arabia to the negotiations table and to lift the blockade and stop this unnecessary war?
The Saudi initiative at this time, this war upon Yemeni people, is a long-term plan that they have oriented themselves and really have put all of their resources behind. This is a very big gambit and push. And so while, as your audience will appreciate, Aramco is Saudi Arabia's state-owned firm, they are the largest concern of its type in the region, they certainly are prepared to take losses. And while this is an important thing to strike and is also important because it is a legitimate military target, being such an economic one, at the same time, my view is that the Saudis are willing to take these types of hit against its oil export concerns, these facilities, and the reason for that is that the thinking behind their adventure in Yemen to oppress and to steal Yemeni's resources is precisely to diversify away from being primarily a crude oil producing country. Yemen is very wealthy in terms of its natural resources, its gold, its copper, and natural gas. So this is the direction that things are going in terms of Saudi Arabia's attempts, which I believe will be futile, to diversify its economy, to further develop its electronics and computer production, microchips and so forth, and the like. Now, what will bring Saudi Arabia to the table will be the fact that they have not been able to see a return on this investment in war. They are bleeding their resources. They had built up an army primarily with some intention at some point of being part of a joint occupational force in Saudi Arabia to go into Syria and into Iraq. Those plans failed, fortunately. And what to do with this army? Well, Yemen is a good target and allows them to fulfill some long-term economic goals, but time is not on their side. They are running out of time, and I believe time will be what does it in for Saudi Arabia. While these attacks on Aramco's facilities are important, they are more symbolic, and they send a lot of the investors on the Saudi side into this conflict into disarray.
Well,
it discourages them and it reduces their confidence in the Saudi.
This is what makes it interesting here, Hakim, because the leader of the Yemeni armed forces, the leader of Ansarullah himself, said Abdul Malik al-Houthi, he said last week while commemorating the 6th year of the war against Yemen that he is ready for, quote, honorable peace, unquote, with Saudi Arabia, but the kingdom has to hold its attacks and lift the blockade of the Yemeni sea and aerial of the Yemeni sea and air. That was his response to a plan which was announced a week earlier by the Saudi Arabian Foreign Ministry. Now, the response came in the form of drones and in the form of missiles. Why not just accept the Saudi initiative and start from there?
You know, Saudi Arabia has been playing fast and loose with the definition of the word peace. What Al-Houthi talks about with an honorable peace is actually just a peace that two sides could agree to. What Saudi Arabia has proposed is in fact a surrender on the part of Yemen's sovereign forces, and this is of course unacceptable. And also I would include that the Ansar Allah leader, Al-Houthi, his insistence that attacks end as a precursor to a final peace is nothing more than saying we would like a ceasefire as we prepare to sit down at the final negotiating table. This is a very normal thing. This is what all countries engaged in hostilities, as they plan to end those hostilities, this is what they do. So suggestions that we see in some really despicable Saudi media that these demands are somehow abstract or unreasonable is purely propaganda, and it's come to be expected from Saudi sources in media. But you know,
well,
we
saw something that was very, very important that we never see in the mainstream media, whether it be it in the Arab mainstream media or the Western one, where tens of thousands of Yemenis rallied across Yemen on Friday to commemorate the war against their country and to show of support for the popular Ansarullah and the Yemeni armed forces in the face of the devastating Saudi-led military campaign. Now, with the blockade, bombing campaigns, with the poverty, with the pandemic, with the starvation, what keeps tens of thousands of people steadfast and sticking to their political opinion through thick and thin?
Well, unlike what we see in some Western coverage of this conflict, this is not a proxy conflict between two regional hegemons. Rather, this is an effort by Saudi Arabia to take over Yemen, to actually expand its territorial, to that Yemen, as far as a functioning state, would cease to exist, and it would just be an adjunct or appendage of Saudi Arabia. The majority of you, many people know this, they're aware of this. They are not lost on this, you know, fact, and they are aware of what the consequences would be of a final Saudi victory, which is, first of all, not militarily possible, because Yemen's allies in the world have not even directly acted yet, whereas we have seen this is overtly Saudi Arabia acting as its own military power after a number of failed gambits to have several Al-Qaeda-type proxies accomplish the same previously, which failed. And now you have Saudi Arabia directly acting in this conflict, and they are not gaining significant ground.
Well, from what you just mentioned, Joaquin, and from the advancement of the Yemeni armed forces to Ma'rib, which is a very oil-rich part of Yemen, what does Mohammed bin Salman still have in his possession to at least bring it along in any future talks with Yemen?
All of these will boil down to the business end of things, and they will actually say, this is where Canada can fit in. You know, Canada has had a concern for the past dozen years with the mineral exports. So there are a number of Western countries which are all in with the Saudi effort, because the Saudis have promised that they will be able to maintain supply line security. As we have said, Yemen is wealthy in gold and silver and copper, and they have the largest arable land and fertile soil. And we saw with the Arab Spring and how food prices were manipulated as the U.S. cornered the market in that following the 2008 bank bailouts. Countries learned they need access to grain. Yemen can possibly even produce more than they've already produced as one of the region's largest producers in this area of grain, of food. So Yemen is very valuable. These are all things that Yemen can say, we are a sovereign state. We can make reasonable negotiations. We can export things that other countries want and need, but you're not going to steal it from us. But I think that keeping a non-ideological approach and being open-minded about the realities of global trade, that a sovereign Yemeni state, after this conflict, will be able to engage with normal trade.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joaquin Flores, analyst and part of the For Truth News website editor there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the politics behind the Suez Canal blockade.
is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Since it was completed in 1869, the Suez Canal has been one of the world's most important bodies of water, a portal between East and West that has been controlled by multiple countries, threatened to ignite war and become a bedrock of the global economy. But the mammoth container ship that had launched itself last week through the waterway possessed a very modern problem. About a tenth of global trade passes through the Suez Canal and made way for an Israeli plan to find its own alternative for the region. Politics behind the Suez Canal blockage in this following report. When the Ever Given container ship ran aground in the Suez Canal on Tuesday, March 23rd, its bulk blocking shipping traffic through the key global thoroughfare, the world looked on, wondering how the authorities would manage to unstick the behemoth. Almost a week later, on Monday, March 29, the vessel was reportedly partially freed from the banks of the Suez Canal, raising hopes the vital waterway could reopen and ease global shipping backlogs. Already, shipping analysts estimated the traffic jam was held up nearly $10 billion in trade each day. So as a salvage team and canal authorities continued their battle to dislodge the four football field-long ship, global supply chains were another day closer to a full-blown crisis. This unfortunate closure of the Suez Canal has simultaneously brought back to debate, spoiler alert, Israeli plans competing with the Egyptian Suez. The Suez Canal has kept its strategic importance for global trade since 1869. However, recently, Israel has started attempts to diminish the canal's importance by constructing a so-called peace train. The railroad project that was presented to public in 2018 plans to connect the Israeli port Haifa with Dubai. It is thus a counterpiece in Trump's Abraham Accords and the Israeli-Arab normalization. Despite the grave cost, Israelis seem to forget about securing real peace and security first. Securing such a railroad might just prove to be costlier than actually profiting from it. This is not the end of it. According to a U.S. 1963 memorandum, which was declassified in 1996, Israel has been planning all along to dig its own canal from Eilat to Ashkelon, despite the fact that this would be very complicated, very difficult, and very, very expensive. Israel and the U.S. still had plans for this project, which would have been implemented by blasting an alternative Suez Canal through Israel using 520 nuclear bombs. Yes, you heard that right. 520 nuclear bombs in the occupied Palestinian Naqab Desert. The memo added that such a canal would be a strategically valuable alternative to the present Suez Canal and would probably contribute greatly to economic development. Stealing and occupying Arab land is not enough now for the Israeli entity. It seems also stealing Egypt's most valuable source of revenue is on their list, too. Again. Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, academic and political analyst. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Wakim. Now, the importance of the Suez Canal stems first and foremost from its location. It is the only place that directly connects the water for between Europe and the Arabian Sea, the Indian Ocean, and the countries of the Asia Pacific. So without the Suez Canal, shipments traveling through parts of the world could take at least 3 weeks if they have to go through the continent of Africa. But this adds a lot of hefty cost and substantial maybe payments for the journey if they don't have to go through the Suez Canal, which is why this ship needs to be freed. Why is Egypt being left alone to deal with this issue? And now, while we're filming this, this is on Monday, our show will be aired on Tuesday, it is being said that the ship is lodged again, it's locked again because of the heavy wind.
Well, the issue is not technical in this sense. First, back to, let's say, ancient history, Egypt has always played the role of the link between the trade of the East Mediterranean and Indian Ocean via the Red Sea. And this had made it not only one of the cradles of civilization alongside Mesopotamia, but also a competitor to Mesopotamia, which enjoyed an alternative line of communication. So history and the international system were born in the Near East based on these trade routes that would crisscross this region. So in modern times, the digging of the, and actually the, it was the ancient pharaohs who were the first to dig a canal that links the Red Sea to the Nile and then to the East Mediterranean. In the modern times, the digging of the canal has not rendered actually an importance to Egypt, a geopolitical importance, but rather it benefited from the location of Egypt on the crossroad and on the intersection of international trade routes to boost this role. And of course, much of the geopolitical identity and the motives, directions, and drives of Egypt are determined by geopolitical aspirations, including the digging of the canal. And it was the digging of the canal that led Egypt to be to get occupied by the British almost a decade later. So the canal was dug in 1869. It was terminated in 1882. Egypt was under occupation. It had to struggle for 7 decades until it won its full independence under Nasser, and then it had to wage a war of independence after nationalizing the canal in 1956. The British, French, and Israelis launched a war against Egypt. And back in then in 1967, another war was determined by the dynamics of this geopolitical importance of Egypt on one hand, and trying to marginalize it by all means, because Egypt is considered as the biggest Arab country, and it's the basis for either controlling the Arab countries if a foreign power controls it, the way the United States did, for example, after the death of Nasser, under Sadat onward, or it could be also the bastion of national liberation, not only in Egypt, but also in the Arab world, the Muslim world, and Africa. And that's why
this gets me to a very important point, Dr. Joachim. I'm sorry I have to cut you in, but it's a very limited time that we have. This, adding to the importance of the Suez Canal, which you presented right now, which is a security and geopolitical importance, Israel now decides to make its own Suez Canal by, first of all, before speaking about how it wants to do it, the cost effect of a process of actually having an alternative canal is $55 billion. U.S. dollars, but apparently the canal would pay for itself in 10 years of operation. How capable do you think such a project would be, and how would that affect Egypt?
Well, first, the issue is addressed by the Israelis not in terms of economic efficiency, but in terms of geopolitical dominance and hegemony. So even if the canal would cost $5 trillion, they would seek to dig it, the alternative canal, because as part of controlling Egypt is to control and jeopardize its water resources. And since the days of Ben-Gurion, for example, there were talks about diverting and controlling the water resources of Egypt, also of Syria and Iraq, with digging with building dams that would control the flow of water in the Tigris and Euphrates in Iraq and Syria, based on a dam that would be built in Turkey, and back then, and of course a dam in Ethiopia. Back then, these talks were taken lightly, too bad, by the successors of Nasser. Nasser took them seriously, by the way. But then, after his death, Sadat took them lightly and considered that his good relations with the Americans would ward off all these threats. However, the Israelis and the Americans were persistent in pursuing these geopolitical goals. They were the ones to support Turkey in building the dam of Ataturk, and they were also the ones to support Annahda dam in Ethiopia.
But
another
this brings us to the project of the U.S. that was the U.S. planning since the 1960s by using 520 nuclear bombs. The this was a classified memorandum by the U.S. It was declassified in 1996. That was just in time, by the way, when the Dimona nuclear reactor was installed inside of the Naqab Desert as well. How do you assess such an unfathomable thought of 520 nukes to open a waterway in the desert in occupied Palestine?
Definitely, because I was talking about ways to control Egypt and put it under chain through controlling the water resources, the Nahda Dam, but also through stripping it from its control of the international, the most important international
waterway,
which is the Suez Canal. And this plan was first forged by Ben-Gurion, the founder of the Israeli entity in 1949, as a mean not only to control the international trade routes and the link between the East Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. One way was to destroy, for example, the port of Beirut and replace it with the port of Haifa and normalize relations with UAE, but also by controlling this waterway or having a waterway of its own. But there is also another dimension for this, which is to earn or to give the Israeli entity natural borders, because the canal would separate occupied Palestine from Sinai on one hand, and also by a branch that would nurture the Dead Sea, it would also separate occupied Palestine from Jordan, naturally. And this would give the Israelis borders that are much easier
official
to defend.
Official borders, just to remind our audience that until now, is the Israeli entity is mainly the only entity in the world that has no borders yet because of its occupation. Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jamal Wakim, academic and political analyst, for joining us to talk about this very important issue that might be the reason for any upcoming next war in the Middle East. I'll be happy to have you on again and talk more about it. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره.
Alhamdulillah, we have been given the blessed opportunity of witnessing another month of Sha'ban, which is the month of Allah's mercy and pleasure. حَفَفْتَهُ بِالرَّحْمَةِ وَالرَّضْوَانِ Allah has covered this month with His pleasure and mercy. I thought it might be good to have a little introduction to Munajat Sha'baniyya, and as you know, this is a very highly regarded whispered prayer that our Imams alayhi salam used to recite. This is mentioned by several ulama in their books. For example, the late Sayyid ibn Tawus in his book Al-Iqbal, the late Allama Majlisi in his Biharul Anwar, Samahiji in As-Sahifatul Alawiyya, and of course Sheikh Abbas Al-Ghumni in his Mafatihul Janan, they all have mentioned this munajat, this whispered prayer from Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Of course, none of them has mentioned the complete chain of narration, but due to its content and due to the high regard that the ulama have always had for this munajat, so it has not been questioned or objected by any scholar. I just start reflecting quickly on some of the sentences of this munajat, hoping that inshallah we would have some opportunity in future to continue. وَتَعْلَمُ مَا فِي نَفْسِي And you know everything about me. You know all my hidden and unhidden needs. Everything you know about me. You know how desperate I am. You know how much I suffer. There is nothing hidden from you. وَتَخْبُرُ حَاجَتِي You know my condition. At the same time, you know my request. وَتَعْرِفُ ضَمِيرِي And you know what is inside my heart. Indeed, Allah says that يَحُولُ بَيْنَ الْمَرْءِ وَقَلْبِ Even before I understand what is happening in my heart, He knows. Sometimes we need to think, maybe for hours, sometimes for